colleague looked surprised. Litigation is not something we are supposed to encourage. But my duty is to him, not to the trust. Isn't that what the GMC piously tells us doctors? I said. If he's been left crippled and somebody's made a mistake, he ought to get some financial compensation, shouldn't he? The irony is that if we hadn't had to have that meeting with that fatuous manager, I'd have been in theatre sooner, and this disaster probably wouldn't have happened. I wish I could blame the manager, I added, but I can't. I went off to write an operating note. It's quite easy to lie if things go wrong with an operation. It would be impossible for anybody to know after the operation in what way it had gone wrong. You can invent plausible excuses. Besides, patients are always warned that nerve damage can happen with this operation, even though I have scarcely ever seen it happen. I know of at least one very famous neurosurgeon, now retired, who covered up an even more major mistake on a very eminent patient with a dishonest operating note. I wrote down, however, an exact and honest account of what had happened. I left the theatre and 30 minutes later saw Judith leaving the recovery ward. Awake? I asked. Yes, he's moving his legs, she said a little hopefully. It's the ankle that matters, I replied gloomily, not the legs. I went round to see the patient. He was only just awake, and was not going to remember anything I said so soon after the operation. So I said little to him and just sadly confirmed my worst fears. He had complete paralysis of lifting the left foot upwards, a foot drop, as it is called in the trade, and, as I had told my junior, it is a very disabling condition. I went to see him 2 hours later, after he had returned to the ward and was fully awake. His wife was sitting anxiously beside him. The operation was not straightforward after all, I said. One of the nerves for your left ankle was damaged, and that's why you can't bend the foot up at the moment. It might get better, I really don't know. But if it does, I'm afraid it will be a slow process that takes months. But it should get better, he asked anxiously. I told him that I didn't know and could only promise to always tell him the truth. I felt quite sick. He nodded in numb agreement, too shocked and confused to say anything. The anger and tears, I thought, as I walked away and dutifully squirted alcohol gel on my hands from a nearby bottle on the wall, will come later. I went downstairs to my office and dealt with mountains of unimportant paperwork. There was a huge box of chocolates on my desk from a patient's wife. I took them through to Gail's office in the next room, as she likes chocolates more than I do. Her office, unlike mine, has a window, and I noticed that it was pouring with rain in the hospital car park outside. The pleasant smell of rain on dry earth was filling her office. "Have some chocolates," I said. I cycled home in a furious temper. "Why don't I just stop training juniors?" I said to myself as I angrily turned the pedals. "Why don't I just do all the operating myself? Why should I have to carry the burden of deciding whether they can operate or not when the fucking management and politicians dictate their training? I've got to see the patients every day on the ward anyway, as the juniors are so inexperienced now, on the few occasions when they're actually in the hospital, that is. Yes, I shall no longer train anybody," I thought with a sudden sense of relief. "It's not safe. There are so many consultants now that having to come in occasionally at night wouldn't be a great hardship. The country's massively in debt financially. Why not have a massive debt of medical experience as well? Let's have a whole new generation of ignorant doctors in the future. Fuck the future. Let it look after itself. It's not my responsibility. Fuck the management, and fuck the government, and fuck the pathetic politicians and the fiddled expenses, and fuck the fucking civil servants in the fucking Department of Health. Fuck everybody." Chapter 15. Medulloblastoma. Noun.
a malignant brain tumour that occurs during childhood. There was a child, Darren, who I had operated on many years ago for a malignant tumour called a medulloblastoma when he was 12 years old. The tumour had caused hydrocephalus, and although I had removed the tumour completely, the condition continued to be a problem, and a few weeks after the operation, I had carried out a shunt operation, implanting a permanent drainage tube into his brain. My son, William, had undergone the same operation after his tumour had been removed for the same reason. William has been fine ever since, but Darren's shunt had blocked on several occasions, a frequent problem with shunts, and he had required several further operations to revise the shunt. He was treated with radiotherapy and chemotherapy, and as the years passed, it appeared that he had been cured. Despite the problems with the shunt, Darren had otherwise done very well, and he went on to study accountancy at university. He had been at university away from home when he started to develop severe headaches. He was brought to my hospital while I was on sick leave with a retinal detachment. A brain scan showed that the tumour had recurred. Although tumours such as Darren's can and do recur, it is usually within the first few years after treatment. For the tumour to come back after 8 years, as with Darren, is very unusual, and nobody had expected it. Recurrence is inevitably fatal, although further treatment can postpone death by a year or two with luck. The plan was that one of my colleagues would operate again in my absence, but the evening before the operation, Darren suffered a catastrophic hemorrhage into the tumour, an entirely unpredictable event that happens occasionally with malignant tumours. Even if he had been operated upon successfully before the hemorrhage, it is unlikely that he would have had long to live. His mother had been with him when he had suffered the hemorrhage. He had been placed on a ventilator on the ITU, but he was already brain dead, and the ventilator was switched off a few days later. I had got to know Darren and his mother well over the years, and I had been very upset to hear of his death when I got back to work, although it was not the first time a patient of mine had died like this. As far as I could make out, his treatment, once he arrived in my department, had been entirely appropriate. But his mother was convinced he had died because of my colleague's delay in operating upon him. I received a letter from his mother requesting an appointment with me. I arranged to see her in my office rather than in one of the impersonal consulting rooms of the outpatient clinic. I brought her into the room and sat her down opposite me. She burst into tears and started to tell me the story of her son's death. He suddenly sat up in bed and clutched his head. My son cried out, help me, Mummy," she said in torment as she told me. I remembered how once a patient of mine dying from a tumour had cried out for help to me and how awful and helpless I had felt. How much worse, I thought, how utterly unbearable it must be if it were one's own child crying for help and if one could not help them. I knew that they should have operated, but they just wouldn't listen to me, she said. She went over the sequence of events over and over again. After 45 minutes, I threw my hands up in the air and shouted in some desperation, "But what do you want me to do? I wasn't there." "I know it wasn't your fault, but I was hoping for some answers," she replied. I told her that as far as I could tell, the hemorrhage could not have been predicted, and it had been perfectly reasonable to plan on operating the next day. I said that the doctors and nurses who had been looking after Darren were terribly upset about what had happened. "That's